It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, that consummate Southern food historian John T. Edge takes on fried chicken. Now, it's a Southern icon, and threatened by the wrath of Dixie, John actually tracks it north. He follows its trail into the KFC bucket and back to the first African-American women entrepreneurs. Well, the Stearns have a gem in Cincinnati, Putz's Creamy Whip. Wine maverick Josh Wesson has a hard-sell name with great flavor, Gruner Veltliner. The Washington Post's T.R. Reid has infiltrated the private dining clubs of Japan. And Gourmet Magazine's Ruth Reichel hits the Brooklyn hotspots with a New York neighborhood maven. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Thank you. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's one of the South's premier food historians taking on a regional deity. John T. Edge is digging into the true story of fried chicken, and along the way, he picks up some great cooking tips. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks a little-known gem, Gruner Veltliner. Now, a while back, journalist T.R. Reid covered eating cheap in Japan. Now he's back with the other end of the spectrum, the rare air of private dining clubs. Then Gourmet's Ruth Reichel tells us a story from her New York restaurant reviewing days about being kidnapped to Brooklyn by the city's ethnic food maven. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, you know, Michael and I have been road fooding for about 30 years now, and I have to say, there is one place, I love the name of this place more than any other restaurant we've ever eaten at. It's called Putz's Creamy Whip, and it's in Cincinnati, Ohio. I could hardly say it.
Yeah, well, it is. There are family names sometimes that you wonder about, aren't there?
Well, here's the strange thing, Lynn. The family that opened Putz's some 40 years ago and still runs it is the Earhart family. So why they called it Putz's Creamy Whip, we don't know.
Isn't a Putz someone who's sort of inept?
Yes. In my childhood, my parents always saying, oh, you know, so-and-so is such a Putz, meaning a klutz or a,
right,
you know, a doofus or something. But, I mean, it's
can we talk about what's important here, which is the Creamy Whip itself?
Oh, okay.
We don't love this place only because it has a silly name.
I do.
Okay. I like it, personally, because they make real old-fashioned custard, the kind you might expect in Milwaukee, which is custard that is made in one of those machines that has almost no overrun. In other words, it's custard made with virtually no air in it. It's dense,
oh boy,
silky, creamy, simple flavor, you know, vanilla or chocolate, nothing elaborate about it, but it's just, it makes you realize how good custard can be. It's nothing like the franchise stuff that you get in the soft serve places,
mm-hmm,
all around the country.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Michael is mad for this place, and it is, I do love it, not just for the name, but they have this white custard ice cream, soft serve like ice cream that they put caramel sauce on and nuts
and chocolate,
and it becomes a turtle sundae, the thing Michael loves the most.
So this place, is it like a restaurant or is it like a stand?
No.
I mean, do you go
It's a stand. I believe there's no place to eat inside. It opens in the spring and closes, uh-huh, in the fall. And they do have a short menu of hot dogs and hamburgers and French fries. But you dine at a picnic table or in your car. It's a real summertime treat. A lot of Cincinnatians go there. You know, when Putz's opens, it means it's summer in Cincinnati.
I have to tell you, frozen custard, you're talking good stuff. Yep. Okay.
Yes. You'll love it.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye. Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Walk up to the counter and you hand her your money. She says, "What's fine? What can I get for you, honey? You know what you want is to take her home, but you settle for vanilla and a sugar cone. I got 31 flavors, but not one as sweet as the girl who serves those ice cream treats."
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, you can hear the Sterns first here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, every time we talk about frozen custard, I promise myself I'm going to check out exactly what it is. Well, at last it's done. Now, for those who have never known a transcendental frozen custard, here is why the fuss. The great ones seem to teeter between melt and firm in this creamy nirvana. Now, I am not talking here fast food soft serve. That's milk high on chemicals, not frozen custard. Now, here's what makes frozen custard. It has 10% Butterfetch is like ice cream. But the other requirement is that it has to have at least 1.4% by weight of eggs. Now, you don't have to have that in ice cream. Also, frozen custard has little or no air whipped into it. The main thing that separates frozen custard from ice cream, though, is temperature. This is what gives it that incredible lushness. It has to be served between 16 and 19 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, ice cream is served hard, you know, like a rock. It's at 10 to 20 degrees below zero. Frozen custard is pure Americana, first done in Coney Island in 1919. I love the mavericks of this world. You know, the people who follow their own instincts no matter what. Well, one of them is our wine authority, Josh Wesson. He's a former sommelier turned bargain hunter. Now, Josh believes everybody should be able to drink good stuff, and he hunts it down around the globe for his bestsellers wine shops. Hey, Josh, welcome back.
Always good to be with you.
Josh, I want to ask you about a wine that I can barely pronounce. Okay, now I'm going to try this. Gruner Vettlinger. Did I get this right?
Well, you left out an L, but you were close enough for rock and roll, at least in Austria. Gruner Veltliner is the king of Austrian white wines, and it's the most famous white wine that most people have never heard of.
Austrian wines are not something we see a lot of on the market. What is this particular wine like, and what grapes does it come from?
Well, Gruner Veltliner is the name of the grape and also the name of the wine. And even though there are many different grapes grown in Austria, most of them white, they grow Riesling there and Chardonnay, uh-huh, Sauvignon Blanc, Gruner is absolutely the king of white wines. It accounts for over a third of all the plantings there. And it's a late ripening grape that just does things that Rieslings and Gewürztraminers can only dream about. It's just a magnificent wine, and if people were to taste it, if you like white wines, I think you'd be hard-pressed not to fall in love with it in some way. It's that alluring. But because you don't often see Austrian wines out and about, it's just a wine waiting to happen.
Well, is it spicy like the Gewürztraminer and has that touch of fruit or almost a hint of sweetness like a Riesling can have?
It has all of those things. You sort of put everything that a Riesling has and everything that a Gewürztraminer, uh-huh, has, put it in the blender and hit frappe. And out comes this magnificent wine, Gruner Veltliner. It's musky. It's citrusy. It's smoky. It's got hints of white pepper and white flowers. It's richer and spicier than most Rieslings. But it's higher in acid and lower in alcohol than most Gewürztraminers. And sometimes it's even made with a little bit of sparkle to it. So it becomes enormously friendly to an enormous range of foods when you sit it on the dinner table.
So which names on the label should we look for? Which makers?
Well, Terry Thies has been sort of the champion of Gruner Veltliner, along with some folks from Chicago who are doing very interesting things, Vin Divino. And the wines that I'm going to tell you about are sort of a stepladder in Gruner, uh-huh, from a training wheels Gruner for, okay, first-timers, all the way up to what I think is one of the most magnificent Gruners made on the planet. Loimer, L-O-I-M-E-R, makes a wine called Lois, very easy to recognize, L-O-I-S. Mm-hmm. It's in this kind of sexy, new wave, green, labeled bottle. It sells for about $12, and it is a magnificent entree to the world of Gruner Veltliner. And that wine is pretty widely distributed, so you shouldn't have a hard time finding it if you're out there looking for one.
Now, what's the next step?
Salomon, S-A-L-O-M-O-N, makes a wine called Hochterrassen. The problem with Gruners, of course, is when you order them, you spit on the waiter as you're placing the order. But that's good, because then they know to bring the Gruner.
Right.
One sells for about $15. And for the extra $3, you get an extra level of flavor intensity and a little bit more richness, a little bit more warmth. And it's worth the $3 once you've started and identified that you like the wine, uh-huh, with something like a Lois, go to the Salomon, and then after that you're ready to, you know, go up into the stratosphere.
And what would be the stratosphere?
The Stratosphere, of course, is always the most difficult to pronounce whenever you're talking about Germanic wines. I think that they charge you by the vowel.
Yes, and by the syllable, definitely.
Exactly.
Definitely.
So this one is Brundlmeier Kamptaler Terrassen, which sounds vaguely sinister, but in fact is one of the most magnificent expressions of Gruner I've ever come across. It's all of $21, so the range of entry level to top of the line is compressed because there's not a great deal of demand for these wines yet. And it is just, you know, as good in my mind as unoaked white wine can be. It will do well over time because it has such beautiful acidity. It can age in the bottle. You can drink it young. You can drink it middle-aged. You can drink it in its dotage. And it will just perform backflips at the dinner table. Fabulous, fabulous wine.
What would you pair with it?
Well, my particular favorites with Gruners, whether it's entry-level or top of the pops, smoked fish and raw shellfish and any kind of fin fish that would ordinarily require a squeeze of lemon, because this wine is a wonderful stunt double for lemon, but it's so much more than lemon.
Mm-hmm.
It has so much depth and so much character that it's in a way a sauce that complements smoked fish, raw oysters, clams, and of course just about any fish that isn't tuna. It's just really, really good.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Josh Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now you can get his Gruner Veltliner picks on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, I think this wine fits in perfectly with a recent email from a listener. It was a question on sugar snap peas, which personally I think should pair beautifully with Gruner Veltliner. Now, the listener writes, I've got a ton of sugar snaps in the garden, and aside from steaming or eating them raw, what can I do? Well, let's go out of the box a bit. Think sweet, savory sorbet. Freeze the peas in their pods and then puree them with a touch of Tabasco and a little sugar. You know, think of it as a slushy, and serve it in tiny glasses and top it with a swirl of sour cream. And of course, sip some of that Gruner Veltliner. Sugar snaps and prosciutto are a dynamite combo. The barely cooked pea pods rolled up in thin slices of prosciutto. Put it out with drinks. Fabulous roasted. Sugar snap peas love to be roasted. Set the oven at 400. Toss them with some Chinese sesame oil, maybe a little bit of soy, some sugar, some ginger if you want, a little bit of garlic, and do this fast brown. And eat them. Fingers, right? And drink the Gruner Veltliner. Now, for more pea ideas, check out the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, while you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, every week we send you a new recipe for a fast worknight supper along with technique and shopping tips. But best of all, guys, it's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, fried chicken, the real story, inside the private dining clubs of Japan, and the missionary of delicious tours, Ruth Reichel, through Brooklyn. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, I want you to meet a man with one of the best jobs I can think of. Historian and writer John T. Edge directs the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi, which means that in the name of work, John gets to plumb one of the richest culinary cultures in the country, the South. Now, never a man to accept limitations, geographic or otherwise, John now is going even further. He's launched a series of short books on America's iconic foods with recipes. His latest is Fried Chicken, An American Story. John, welcome.
My pleasure.
Now, John, I have to question you. Is this an American food? Because fried chicken has existed in other countries before America, hasn't it?
Indeed, it has. I mean, you could make good arguments for China. You can make good arguments for any number of countries. And yet, what Americans have done is we've made it distinctly American by way of kind of a process of commodification. It has become this dish, in many ways inspired by the Colonel Sanders, you know, rags to riches story. Yeah. It's become this dish that is of America that says, with my secret herbs and spices, I too will ascend to the great heights of wealth. And that to me is distinctly American. The other thing that's distinctly American about this dish are the people that cook it and the stories behind them. And as I travel the country, that's what really resonated with me. As much as the food, as much as the recipes, it was the people.
Now, I remember one of your colleagues, James Villas, who comes from the South, had once said, unless you're Southern, you can't fry chicken.
And Mr. Villas was, I believe, engaging in a bit of hyperbole. And yet I take the first sentence in my book to call him out on that and say that, you know, there is this instinct among Southerners. And as a Southerner, I can call my own people out on this, and that we tend to overemphasize our traits. We tend to say that, you know, the summers are muggier and the girls are prettier and the fried chicken is better way down south of the Mason-Dixon. And to a certain degree, sure, it's true, but a lot of it, I think, comes in kind of the tale-telling about the dish and about our culinary traditions. You know, in many ways, the South tells a better story about itself because there was that nasty stuff that we didn't want to talk about or that we tried to explain away. And I think music and food are answers to that peculiar history, to those dark days. And I think fried chicken offers you kind of entree to both thinking about those dark days and to celebrating the good that came out of that, out of this shared culture of black and white.
What role did fried chicken play with African Americans in the South?
Well, it comes back, I think, to this entrepreneurship that I spoke of earlier, this idea that African American cooks in leaving the plantation, in going forth into the world, could take the skills that they honed on the plantation. Not that they were bequeathed on the plantation, but that they honed on the plantation and make their way. There's a wonderful story I came across in researching this book on the women of Gordonsville, Virginia, who would, in the late years of the 1800s, meet the trains that came through Gordonsville. At one time, it was a major railroad junction. And they would meet the trains carrying platters of fried chicken on their heads and would sell fried chicken by the piece, to the point where one commentator, George Bagby, referred to Gordonsville as the chicken leg center of the universe. it became this nexus of commerce and culture. And these women became known around the country for their ability, for their marketing acumen. I mean, think about it. We're really talking about somebody selling a product and selling it well. And that, I think, is as much a part of the African-American story, the story of fried chicken, as is some kind of sepia-toned recollection of grandma on the hearth. This is a way of making it in the world.
Well, John, the cook in me has to ask you something else. You have now tasted fried chicken all over the United States. What are some of the real secrets that you learned, the stuff that really makes it stand out?
Well, a couple of things that I found that worked really well and were things I brought home to my own kitchen. One, I learned from Austin Leslie, a great cook from New Orleans, for years ran a place called Chez Helene down in New Orleans, and now cooks at a place called Pampy's Creole Cuisine in New Orleans. Mr. Leslie chops up a confetti of garlic and parsley. So he'll pull the chicken from the oil, lay atop it a couple slices of dill pickle. And the dill pickle will leach out into the crust.
Right.
And then he'll chop up the parsley and confetti of garlic and then sprinkle that atop. And it has this way of kind of pointing up the flavor and cutting the grease, at the same time. And it's delightful. And, you know, the pickle juice will really surprise you. You'll think, what is this? The other thing that I learned from, an haute cuisine chef, a good friend, John Fleer, who's a chef of the Inn at Blackberry Farm up in Wallen, Tennessee, in the foothills of the Great Smokies. John takes the house wine of the South, that being sweet tea. you know, the kind of tea that'll make your molars ache, two thimblefuls in. And John marinates his chicken for 2 days in a brine of tea, sweetened tea, with a little bit of salt, a little bit of Old Bay, a few other things. He'll leave that in the refrigerator for a couple of days, then pull it out, then make a coating of buttermilk and a little bit of masa, a little bit of flour, Old Bay again, and then fry it hard, and then let it rest in the refrigerator for a couple of days. When you pull it out of the refrigerator, it's cold, and is a great antidote to the swelter of summer. And when you bite in, you get this delightful consomme of Lipton's that dribbles down your chin. It makes for great fried chicken. And it's also something that's really very simple in its, you know, in principle and in execution. You just have some time to do it.
John, thank you.
My pleasure.
Historian John T. Edge directs the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi. Now, he's the author of Fried Chicken, An American Story. Now, there is no way I'm going to let John go without leaving us his recipe for sweet tea fried chicken. You can get it on the website, guys, splendidtable.org. Editor and writer T.R. Reid is the Washington Post's Rocky Mountain bureau chief. He's also a man who is known to travel for a meal, and I mean a meal anywhere, from London to maybe even Nepal. T.R., welcome back.
Hi, Lynn. Very nice to be here.
T.R., I have heard in journalism circles, the word is that you have had, I don't even know if you could call this an assignment, evidently you were sent to Japan by Neiman Marcus.
Eat High on the Hog for their frequent shopper magazine entree. Does this sound like a tough job, Lynn?
This is a very tough job, sir. Yeah.
But the things we put up with.
I know.
And if you want to eat high on the hog in Japan, it's very obvious where you want to go. You want to go to one of these very exclusive Japanese places called a Dyotei. This is from two characters that mean dining pavilion. You're looking at $400 to $500 a person, but you know, it's almost worth it. They're fantastic meals.
What is this place? It's not a restaurant then.
A Dyotei is kind of a mix between a restaurant and a private club. They're very secretive. If this is where politicians go to make their deals or where CEOs finish the work on the big merger. So they've arranged it so that everybody has a private room and you enter and leave the hallway on a time scale so that you never see another client. Everything is private. It's a little hard to get into. In fact, if you want to go to a Dyotei, you need a shokai, an introduction. I had a friend of mine at the U.S. Embassy do it. Sometimes the concierge at a good hotel is good enough to get you in.
So tell me about the experience. I mean, what do you walk into? What is this like?
Oh, we went to this wonderful old 110-year-old house in Tokyo called Jisaku. Every room is a beautiful tatami room, and you roll up the white rice paper screens, and outside everybody has his own pond with their own private waterfall falling into the pond, birds flying by. The only sound you hear is the rippling water and your sake being poured by your waitress. You get about five waitresses in beautiful kimono for each room. And they kind of talk you through it. When we went to Jisaku, our head waitress was named Keiko, and Keiko said to me, well, the theme for this evening is small boats. You have any idea what that means?
Well, small boats, canoes, you know, small boats.
I didn't know what it meant. But here's what it turned out to mean. It meant every course, and we're talking, you know, 13 or 18 courses here, every course is served in a kind of food carved into a small boat. That's the serving platter.
Huh.
A Japanese daikon, you know, a big radish.
Yeah, yeah.
A melon. One was served in a mango, a couple of cucumbers. And then the dessert was served in a boat made of crushed ice coated with the petals of morning glory.
Oh,
we're talking heaven.
So now, all right, many courses. Tell me, what was the food? What were you eating?
Every course is about two bites, and you really savor it. It's fantastic. I just wrote down a few things that were particularly good. Japanese pear, that's nashi. This is a fresh Japanese pear rolled in seasoned duck meat. Then we had fried matsutake mushrooms in crushed chrysanthemum pollen. Marvelous. I usually don't like kurage because kurage means jellyfish. I usually try to avoid that in Japanese restaurants. But they had this mild kurage jellyfish flavored with yuzu, which is a very light kind of Japanese lemon. Oh, my gosh, that was marvelous. Served on ice. It was absolutely marvelous course. And then they brought out this delicious fresh crab coated with shungiku, which is the leaves of young chrysanthemum. If you pick the leaves before the chrysanthemum blooms, it's kind of a nice green. And that was served on tiny little platters carved of cucumber. God, what a course.
How long did the meal last?
We went about 2 to 2.5 hours. I was having an absolutely lovely time. And I don't think I had any budget restriction, but the meal itself was about $400 a person, and then we started drinking sake that was outrageously priced. So when we got to, when we were up near $1,000 for two, I got worried, and we decided we better have dessert and leave.
So when you were presented the bill, were you shocked?
Well, please, in a jote, they would never present you a bill. They would never sully a meal like this with concept of money. No, they send you a letter the next day and telling you how much it costs. This, of course, is why you need an introduction to get there. They don't want any deadbeats walking in. But you just leave the restaurant and thank them for the lovely meal, and course things like paying for it, that's left for later.
Thank you, sir.
Well, my recommendation is go there and then bill it to Neiman Marcus. Work for me.
I may take you up on that.
Try it.
Take care.
Yeah. Sayonara.
T.R. Reid is the Washington Post Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief and author of The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. In her new memoir, Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise, Ruth Reichel writes about her years as the New York Times restaurant critic. It's a tale full of the inside scoop, self-discovery, and food, from the sublime to the ridiculous. But we join her in a seemingly simple task, strolling the aisles, grocery shopping with a particular recipe in mind.
Gathered mints, scallions, and fresh garlic into my cart and went off to find the wonton wrappers. As I passed the bread, a baguette called to me, and as I reached for it, a voice said, "Not that one." Looking up, I found a man with a boyish face staring at me. His warm brown eyes and mischievous grin seemed surprised to find themselves attached to such an oversized and awkward body. With one hand, the man dangled a baguette before me. With the other, he stopped my reaching arm. "Take this," he said. "It's baked later and delivered earlier." "Hi, Ed," I said. I barely knew Ed Levine, but he had a reputation as the ultimate connoisseur of New York food. For years, well-intentioned friends had been telling me that I should cultivate his friendship. Nobody, they assured me, knew more about the city's edible landscape. There was apparently not a pizzeria in the city that Ed hadn't sampled. If I wanted to meet the jerk chicken king of Brooklyn or the tofu man of Flushing, Ed could introduce me. But although we had been introduced any number of times, neither of us had pursued the acquaintance. Ed was full of opinions. I should be buying this olive oil instead of that. My coffee should come from next door, and he did not approve my choice of smoked salmon. But his enthusiasm was so infectious that you couldn't be annoyed. When he said that my Afghan dumplings would surely be better with yogurt from the Middle Eastern store in Bay Ridge, I suspected that he was right. I could take you there, he offered. He stopped himself, eyes gleaming. In fact, why don't you let me take you on a food tour of Brooklyn? You'll meet some amazing people. Bakers and butchers are undervalued in our culture, and they're so happy when you recognize what they do. We'll have a great time. Please come. How could I possibly refuse? Ed, it soon became clear, was a trusting driver who relied on his car to take care of itself when he was otherwise occupied. For long stretches, he looked at me, at the itinerary, at the passing scenery. I haven't seen that bakery before, he'd cry, swerving across three lanes to get a closer look, convinced that any cars foolish enough to be in our path would move before we reached them. We came out of the tunnel and nosed deep into Carroll Gardens. Ed gestured around and said happily, "Isn't this neighborhood wonderful?" He parked, setting off a couple of car alarms in the process. They were howling as we walked into Esposito's pork store, but Ed paid them no mind. It was comfortable in there, rich with spice and personality, a throwback to a vanishing New York. Housewives with loud nasal voices demanded this piece of veal breast, that slice of bretzel, and a little salami, not too thick. Are you listening to me? They examined the heap of softly steaming stuffed peppers, asking when they were made, and wanted to know if this was yesterday's sausage and where the hell was today's. Firemen from around the corner stood shouldering their axes and arguing over their order, scooping up mountains of chopped meats and cold cuts. "Isn't this great?" asked Ed, as if he had personally conjured the scene. "Isn't this amazing? Doesn't it make you happy that places like this exist?" His enthusiasm was irresistible. Ed's next gift was a tiny shop filled with bakers mixing dough, melting chocolate, pulling pastries from industrial ovens. When Ed stepped through the door, they all stopped to welcome him. "What they make here," said Ed, grabbing a small pastry from one of the pans, "is the most amazing rugelach I've ever found." He popped one buttery little morsel into his mouth and then another. By his eighth, he was shaking his head sadly and saying, "It makes you realize how much bad rugelach there is in the world. Oh, okay, I'll have just one more." The car alarms had finally subsided when we climbed back into the car, but as Ed pulled out of the parking space, they started up again, sending us off with a flourish we could hear for blocks. The sound faded into the distance as the car plowed through the Brooklyn traffic, heading for Bay Ridge. "Look," said Ed, suddenly slowing to a crawl. He pointed out the window, simultaneously lifting his foot from the gas. "Look at that collision of cultures." As Ed indicated, a Mexican grocery store, an Asian emporium, a Scandinavian shop, the car slowly drifted to a standstill. He gazed beatifically out the window as a cacophony of angry honking started up. "Don't you just love New York?" asked Ed, setting the car back in motion.
Ruth Reichel was reading from her book Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. Ruth is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, this is From the Sublime to the Ridiculous. The question is, what kinds of animals are in that box of animal crackers? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Castor, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what kinds of animals are in that box of animal crackers? Well, tradition dictates gorillas, bears, camels, rhinos, elephants, tigers, monkeys, sheep, a buffalo, a lion, and in 2002, a koala bear was added. Now, the koala bear joined the menagerie to celebrate Animal Crackers' 100th anniversary. The National Biscuit Company, soon to become Nabisco, created them in 1902. The Barnum and Bailey Circus was the inspiration. Now, according to an article by Jennifer Frey in the Washington Post, animal crackers are vegan, but most of us eat them in a decidedly non-vegan manner. We bite their heads off.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
Maybe the lines are officially open and you can reach us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Okay, let's see who is on the line. We have Joelle from Key West. Hey, Joelle, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I have a question about Ethiopian food. We used to live in Washington, D.C., and we'd go out to Ethiopian restaurants, and they make that special bread that you actually eat with.
That's right. It's like it's actually put down on a big tray, and then the food's put on top of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I have never been able to find a recipe or even know what that bread is called.
Oh, God, you know, we've got a bunch of Ethiopian restaurants that have opened in our area, and you can really get hooked on it. And I'm lucky. I can go into a market and buy it.
Ah.
What it is called is injera. And it's what's interesting about it is that truly authentic injera is made with a flour from a grain that's the size of a piece of sand. It's called teff, T-E-F-F. And occasionally you'll find teff flour in food co-ops and, you know, places that sell organic, natural, that kind of thing. But you can mail order it, too. I know it's got to be up there. And from what I have never made injera, but from what I understand of how it's done, it's essentially that the teff flour is blended with water, maybe a little salt, and it's literally left to sit out and collect wild yeasts. For those of you who have never had this, the bread is almost a gray color, that just a gray brownish color. You can tell there's grain in it, but it's spongy. It's not soppy. It's not heavy in that sense, but it is very spongy. And it's been cooked on a huge round griddle. And it's been cooked so that it cooks all the way through. And that sponginess from the natural yeast becomes the whole texture of the bread. And you tear off pieces and you pick up whatever little bit you want of this curry or that sauteed vegetable. It's a wonderful way to eat. And
it really is.
It's healthy as all get out. Now, finding you a recipe. By the way, I have heard from cooks here from Ethiopia that, you know, teff has no gluten in it, meaning it doesn't hold together very well. And to make life easier, they'll mix teff flour with just whole wheat flour.
Okay.
Or even white flour. And then they'll make the injera. I think if you go on the internet, look under Marcus Samuelson. Marcus Samuelson is a chef in New York who was born in Ethiopia, raised in Scandinavia, but he does recipes in his book, I think, from Ethiopia.
Oh.
And the other person to check out with her writings would be Jessica Harris, who is an ethnologist and a food historian and a food writer who has spent a lot of time in Africa and some time in Ethiopia.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Tana calling from Canyon Lake, Texas. Tana, hi. What do you want to talk about?
I need to know what to do with a ton of jalapenos. I grow jalapenos every year, and I get them up until November. And I have so many of them that I usually just end up letting them rot and seed and,
poor jalapenos.
They go to waste. And I want to make some kind of sweet and hot, like chutney or relish or something like that.
Boy.
The only thing I know what to do is salsa.
Well, you know, but you know, salsas are a great place to begin because any chutney or relish is a cooked salsa. I mean, if you think about it, it's, you know, it's spice and vinegar of some sort, some kind of acid, because that's what preserves it. A couple of things come to mind. Well, you know, one of the things, you probably know this because you live in Texas and you guys do all sorts of great things, but jalapeno loves fruit. And I just wonder if you took any kind of like a peach chutney or an apple chutney recipe or a green tomato chutney recipe, you're going to find this all over the internet. You're going to find it in books and threw in a lot of chopped up jalapeno. I think you would get a great chutney. It would be hot and it would be sweet and it would be sour.
See, I've found a mango chutney.
Yeah.
Really good. I was wondering maybe that.
That would be fabulous. And you know the other place I would go? I'd go to Indian cookbooks. There are chutneys in Indian cookbooks that are fabulous. Madhur Jaffrey, Jaffrey, is one great source. And Raghavan Iyer, Iyer, another great source. Simple recipes. And the other thing you might want to do, I do this little trick, which I love with jalapenos, is I take vinegar and brown sugar in a pan. So let's say 2 cups of cider vinegar, a cup of brown sugar, and I throw into that about 5 cut up jalapenos. And I let that boil down until it's a syrup. And then I stir in fresh jalapenos and I just put that in the refrigerator and I use that. I put that, drizzle that over fish when it comes off the grill. I'll marinate things in it. It's like a syrup and it's sour and it's sweet and it's hot all at the same time.
Making my mouth water.
Well, you know what it comes from? It's so interesting because it's really an American take on a French classic. When you boil sugar and vinegar down to almost a syrup, it has a terrible name in French. It's called gastrique. But it occurred to me, hey, you know, chilies in this would really be fabulous. And you get the cooked chili and the fresh chili taste that way.
Okay, I'll try that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing you can use it. It's great over ice cream, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, and if you've never tried folding some chopped up jalapeno, not too many, but fold that into vanilla ice cream, I have to tell you, it blows your mind, and it's really good. The sweet creaminess of the ice cream. Remember, heat is cut by fat. You know, the substance that makes chilies hot is soluble in fat. So when you have something rich like ice cream, it pulls back the heat a bit, but you still get some bite.
I see. Should I like saute the jalapenos or just put them in there
no,
fresh?
No, put them in raw.
Raw,
okay. Chop them up and put them in raw, and you are in business.
You've given me a lot of ideas.
Yeah, go out and play, you know?
All right, thanks a lot.
Try the syrup, because syrup, I think, is killer, and nobody does it. You'll be the only person doing it. Hey, thanks for a great question.
Okay.
I was thinking the other night that just about every week, I do what I think of as the 45-minute brine on the chicken breasts or on the steak or whatever. You know, brining is the business of taking salt water, maybe it has flavorings in it, and immersing some kind of meat or fish in it or poultry, and it gets all plumped and juicy. And a lot of people think they have to be able to do it overnight. But what I've realized is whenever you have something small, like a chicken breast or a fish fillet or even a piece of steak or a chop, throwing it into a brine for a half hour or 45 minutes in the refrigerator really makes a difference. It really plumps stuff out. I do it with chicken breasts all the time because they tend to be dry. What I do is I figure for every quart of water, I've got about 3 tablespoons to 4 tablespoons of kosher salt. I like to use kosher salt because the iodized stuff kind of has a funny taste. And then if you want to, you can add an equal amount of sugar to that. I add often chili powder, New Mexico chili powder. Not an awful lot, maybe about 2 tablespoons. You don't taste it, but you just get this kind of backdrop. Now, if you want to get any other flavoring into the brine, you got to use a ton of it. You've got to use a lot. So if you want to have garlic, use 10 or 12 cloves of garlic. So you have cold water, you have your salt, you have whatever your flavoring could be, and then you drop in whatever things you want to brine, stick them in the fridge, forget about them for 45 minutes, and then just cook them the way you normally cook them. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up next. We have got Chris calling from St. Louis. Chris, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I was in my local natural food store and happened to come across a package of black Chinese rice.
Uh-huh.
And I use a rice cooker to cook all my rice.
Right.
Wasn't sure exactly whether it's more like brown rice, more like white rice, how exactly I should cook it, what should I do with it. It's just one of those things that it just struck me, and I'm like, I've got to try this out. And then I get it home and go, okay, now what am I going to do with it?
Welcome to my world. Yeah, you know, I do this all the time. I go to a store, I see all this unfamiliar stuff, and I come home with shopping bags. And my husband says to me, another collection for the pantry shelf, which we will find in 5 years.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. I always feel it's sort of going to be an archaeological dig, you know, me and thee in our closets.
Mm-hmm.
When we're gone, they'll find all these fascinating things and know how exotic we really were.
Exactly.
You got
exactly. Don't have the basics, but have all the exotic stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, what's life about?
Sure.
But black rice, now black rice is really interesting because it shows up in a lot of different places. And I'm like you. I think it's irresistible. Generally speaking, if I remember correctly, Chinese black rice is a medium grain rice. Now, that means that, you know, it's like a risotto rice in the sense that it's not going to be really fluffy.
Right.
And what you want to do, it's unmilled, if I remember correctly. And what you want to do is rinse it. It's
right.
And when you first start to rinse it, the water's going to be purplish black.
Okay.
And you'll still keep the color in the rice. You rinse it until the water's more or less clear.
All right.
And some of these rices take longer to cook, and some of them cook very quickly. They cook like in a half hour. This is what you should figure. For every cup of rice, you want 1 1/4 cups of water. That's my general thing for most rices, because I always figure I can add a tad more water as it cooks if I have to.
Right.
But I don't want to have too much. And I would set it at about a half hour, and then I would look at it and see. Okay.
Okay.
And then you can see if you want to go further. And I think that, you know, it's one of the, I found black rice from China that took an hour to cook, and I found black rice from China that was ready, you know, while we were still having drinks.
Okay.
So I think plan on the half hour, but give yourself about 20 minutes leeway, because you can always hold it.
Now, what sort of flavor is it?
Nutty. The ones I've had are nutty. Some of them are almost wine-like. You know, they always remind me a little bit of a red wine.
Mm.
And I just throw a little bit of salt in there. I mean, that's it. But one of the things that's so sexy about them is they look great.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, they look pretty. They don't come out quite as black once they're cooked because the inside is a white kernel.
Sure.
But they're still pretty exotic looking. And think about what you might want to serve with them. Like, you know, you might want to do some bright, really bright green, barely steamed or barely stir-fried sugar snap peas, because you get the bright green and the black. And I mean, you can really have fun with this stuff.
All right. That's fabulous.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Goodbye. Call us, guys. 800-537-5252. You know, every time you see a colored rice, buy it. The worst thing you'll do is undercook it. You know, and just remember the formula. 1 cup rice, 1 1/4 cup water. You can always add a little more water. You can cheat, but you can't pull water away. Well, it was bound to happen. With all the gender and diet-targeted foods, a girly wine had to come about. Now, Beringer Blass Wine Estates has created something called White Lie Early Season Chardonnay. Now, we have Beringer's Director of Global Innovation, Tracy Mason, on the line. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So now explain to me, what is White Lie Early Chardonnay?
White Lie Early Season Chardonnay is a wine that we created through a unique method to really attract today's female consumer. So it was about understanding that women today have very crazy lifestyles. And what we learned when we spoke to them is that they often gave up wine during the week because of the high alcohol content. So they would wait until the weekend to indulge. So we thought, as women who enjoy wine, wouldn't it be great if we could create a really premium California wine with a bit less alcohol? So we felt, as a team of women, that it would really be interesting to position that wine to the same women that we consider ourselves to be, which are wine lovers.
So how did you actually make this?
What we did was we actually picked our grapes out of our best Santa Barbara vineyards a bit earlier than we typically pick our grapes in California. What winemakers are doing here is they leave the grapes on the vine for a very long time. What that does is gets this amazing flavor in the grapes, but when you leave the grapes on the vine for a long time, the sugars are very high, so therefore when you ferment them, the alcohol content's really high. And I think that's a great thing, and there's certainly many occasions where that's the right thing to be consuming.
Right.
But it was, again, it was about this opportunity. If you didn't need to, or didn't want to consume all that alcohol, wouldn't it be great to have another option?
So what does it taste like?
It's very light on the palate. It's got almost a very Pinot Grigio texture and feel to it. And it's very, I would say, green apple and pear on the tongue.
Have you gotten any backlash from female wine lovers who feel, whether you call it or not, girly, but a wine aimed at females perhaps is a tad insulting?
We have. And what I say to that is I find it interesting that women would find it to be insulting. Again, this was a team of very, very evolved, very liberated women that came up with this idea. And it wasn't about necessarily talking down to women. What it was asking more women to engage with wine and doing it in a way that we felt was fun and less intimidating. And the majority of the responses from women has been unbelievably positive, unbelievably so.
Well, Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
Tracy Mason is Director of Global Innovation for Beringer Blass Wine Estates. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this French proverb. It goes, "The best use for bad wine is to drive away poor relations." The Splendid Table from American Public Media is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.